Here we go. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, not burdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be happy, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to false views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Okay. It's all okay now? Hopefully. Okay. Well, one of the important things about meditation and Dharma practice in many different ways is just the fact that it gives us such a quality of life. There are few things really that can bring us back to ourselves, to this moment, to everything else, in such a way that makes it beautiful, that makes it wonderful. The thing is that meditation is useful because it slows things down. We live in very, very busy times. We live in COVID, we live in everything else. There's so many different things happening all over the planet now. And the good thing is, in some ways, we have far more information than we ever had before. So much more in terms of media, so much more in terms of science and education and all these wonderful things. The problem is, we have so much information, it's very, very difficult to process it all and to work out exactly what's right, what's not, false news, fake news, and all these different problems that we have today. So meditation's really, really useful because it can slow things down. One of the big problems we have generally is that we're so busy, we're so turbulent in our mind and in our society and everything else, that we don't actually have time to kind of settle down and think things clearly. But also, there's all this background stuff as well, all these concerns and anxieties and hopes and fears and dreams and everything else that kind of get in the way and can kind of skew the angle that we look at things. And that can be quite difficult because then pretty much everything else is out of whack. And it's a big cascader thing. One small thing wrong here can make a problem here. It's a bit like a mental butterfly effect. That old sort of metaphor of a butterfly that flaps its wings on one side of the planet, causes a thunderstorm on the other side of the planet. It's a very similar thing with the mental world as well. Just a small little idea here that could be incorrect can shape all these other ideas that can make things very, very difficult to be able to see clearly. And so meditation allows us just to put those things down for a little while, just to settle, just to become a bit more calm and sort of fresh eyes, so to speak. And that's always useful in any context, because it's so difficult these days with so many things happening, just to be able to keep track of things. You know, there's work, there's family, there's so many different things that we have to take care of. And even as in the monastery, you know, there's so many things we have to take care of. So just as important. And so it's always very useful just to enjoy it. Just to enjoy it. You know, it's a time to sit down. Just be here. See what comes. The thing is that unfortunately in this world, because we're so attracted to information and ideas and methods and techniques and everything else, we present meditation in a very structured format because, of course, it's very easy to teach and it's very easy to understand. It's just, you know, A, B, C, D, this is what you do. The problem is that we then try to follow that method a bit like a recipe. And at the beginning, that's very useful, but like cooking, there gets to be a point where you know what you're doing more or less, and you just put the recipe book by the side and you can just go with whatever comes out of the kitchen. Because the mind is like that. Every time it's different. And every time it's wonderful. Even the horrible ones. Quite honestly, even the horrible meditations where you're just tense and you're tired and you're just going, oh, what am I doing? Those are very interesting because they show us, they reveal to us what our mind is like. They show to us that we're tired. They show to us that we're overworked. We've got too much going on. We have too many concerns and anxieties. And we need a break. So meditation's wonderful for this because it helps us bring us back to find out what we really need. And then we can move forward. And that's so important in this day and age, in any sense of the term. We live in such a complex time. So with the meditation, there's so many different approaches that it's also useful to know that the approach for you is unique to now. It's unique to yourself and it's unique to today. So today you might find that you need more of a relaxation type. Tomorrow you might find a bit more contemplation style or a bit more different themes, different styles to deal with what you're getting to. Because the center of meditation is these two things called vipassana and samatha. And these two words are very, very big in Buddhism. I'm sure many of you have heard these two things before. Samatha means sort of calmness, stillness. And the vipassana means to see clearly. It's often translated as insight, like as a noun, but actually it's more the process of seeing clearly, the act of seeing clearly. And if you are very turbulent in your mind, very anxious, very frustrated, very concerned, very tired, very shaky, you can't see clearly. So you need to calm the mind down and you can see clearly. These things go together. And the more you calm the mind down, the deeper you can see. Because the thing is that we have so many firewalls in our own mind. The way our mind is really built is to protect us from so much of these things in the world. So many of these little problems that we have, that deep inside of us, we look at the world and we say, this is too much. I can't deal with this. I don't know how to deal with this. I don't know what this is. Too hard. I've got too much to deal with. And all these firewalls that we put up to help us, and of course, at the beginning, they're very, very powerful and very, very important firewalls because this is how we navigate life. This is how we navigate the world. So they're incredibly useful. But there gets to be a point that these firewalls become a bit of a prison and a bit of a blockage for us to be able to see beyond them. And that can be a problem. Because then all we're really doing is we're stuck in this tiny little bubble that we've created for ourselves, and it gets a bit stale. So the meditation helps us to calm that down. We don't need to be so afraid of the world. We're just sitting here. We're just calmly sitting here. This is a safe place. We're in our homes or in our meditation rooms or wherever we are. It's fine. We can meditate here. We can rest here. And that lowers those firewalls just a little bit, and we can breathe again. Oh, I don't need to have all this, keep the world out, keep it all away and everything else. And we realize that a lot of the troubles that we have, sometimes we overrate them. Sometimes we do make too much of them. And sometimes it's the other way. Sometimes we underrate things. Sometimes there's this big issue, but we're just ignoring it because we can't deal with it yet. And it might, if it doesn't come up in our meditation, it often comes up in our dreams, because that's when the mind is sort of saying, he or she is not listening. Here's our opportunity. And you get these dreams which give very clear messages to you. So the meditation also can allow that space for these things to come up. So we can say, what do I really need at the moment? How's my life going? We can take this in a new positive direction. And that's what meditation is really, really useful for. And sitting meditation, of course, is very, very important, but it does, of course, come in other forms. There's walking meditation. There's lots of different things that you can do. Painting can be a meditation. There's great history of calligraphy and other poetry, sort of as a meditation kind of thing. That helps too. That also is ways of calming things down so that we can access what we need, because we have so many things that we have to face. And sometimes we just need that break. We need that bit of clarity. And that is the greatest gift. So with the meditation, enjoy it. We approach meditation, particularly in Buddhism, unfortunately, as we have a certain style. So we have to sit this way. We have to have our arms like this. We have to cross our legs like this and fold our hands like this. And we have to sit until the incense stick burns down or the candle burns out, or until, a little alarm clock or something has its special timer. And, it's very kind of ritualized, controlled. I must do it this way. I sort of mentioned the recipe before, and those are only guidelines. It's about building confidence in yourself, that friendship with yourself, that you want to be with yourself, and just be here. And that's all. So in this meditation approach, it doesn't have to be so structured, even though it's so useful at times. If you're very new to meditation, and some of you may be, having these structured formats is great. As time goes on, there's times that they get useful, there's times they get a bit stale, and you kind of want to or need to try something a bit different. So I'm just going to quickly look at the clock here. How much I've been going 20 minutes. That's pretty good. We can expand these things. We can explore new things. And that's the fun. That's the adventure. Meditation is an adventure. It just doesn't look like it. It just looks like we're just sitting there. You've got a little Buddha statue like this where he's kind of, that's all it is. But actually it doesn't have to be just that. Because it's about you and how meditation can be a tool in your life and helping other people as well, because those things work together. They grow off each other. And this is the thing. When it's such a beautiful gift and such a beautiful thing to do, life is so much easier. And you can enjoy your time with other people, and you can enjoy the things you do. Because life is too short for all this controlling and misery and our expectations, many of which we're, told to believe, mostly by advertising and things like that. We're made to expect that we should have a great big house and the car and kids and all this and all this and all that. And when you get it, well, then what? What are we supposed to do now? And this is a bit of a problem. One of these big, big things that meditation helps with is it allows us to accept that we can enjoy those things, but they're not really going to fix the real problem. Because the real problem is just how we approach the world. Because how we approach the world externally is a reflection of what's going on internally. So the state of our mind, our state of our heart and everything else, that comes out. And that's how we live in the world, is a reflection of what's inside. And so we have all these problems that, you know, the way that we treat each other and is very much the way we sort of treat ourselves on a very deep level, for better or worse. The way we treat the environment and everything else is just a reflection of what's inside. And sometimes it's pretty scary. It is. But the meditation helps us to deal with that. We can have compassion. We can have loving kindness. We can have joy. Because there's so little joy around these days. So every little bit is wonderful. And we can have the acceptance that this is life. This is life. And we can make it more beautiful. It doesn't have to be perfect, but we can enjoy it and make it something special. So, still got a few more minutes to go. So what we can do is actually skip ahead and go into the meditation. Would that be okay with everyone? Thumbs up.
Sounds wonderful, venerable. Sounds wonderful.
Marvelous. You can kind of tell I like the meditation bit. Let's go for it. Okay. So first thing, if you need to, give yourself a bit of a shake, adjust yourself in the chair, adjust your legs if you need to. The thing is that you've already been sitting down for a while, which is good because that helps the joints to relax, but they sometimes open up a bit and that can kind of feel a bit sort of stretchy and tight. So just give yourself a bit of a wiggle and help yourself settle into the chair nice and comfortably. And then when you're ready, you can close your eyes. And the first thing to do is just take a few calming breaths. Just feel the breath. Just use that breath to go, ah, I can relax now. Nice and quiet now. And what we're going to do tonight is use the breath to relax ourselves more. So imagine the breath filling you, filling every part of your body. And as you do that, breathing in and out, just see where there's any tension and use the breath to relax it. It doesn't matter at all how you breathe. But just let it go naturally. How does it feel? Does it feel nice? Does it feel relaxed? Does it feel like you're settling in? If there's any tension, just relax it. Adjust your body if you need to. Being able to relax is a great skill and a wonderful opportunity. If your mind wanders, that's fine. Just let it go. It's like a dog that you take to the park. When you take the dog off the leash, it runs around wherever it wants. But you sit there on the park bench, and you'll find your dog comes straight back to you and sits by you. And how does it feel around your head and your face? Is there any tension? Is there a chance for a soft smile? Use the breath to relax the face and head. And now check the head, the shoulders, and your neck. Is there any tension there? The shoulders and the neck often hide a lot of tension. Now is the time that you can relax them and soften them up. Now pay attention to your upper body and see if there's any tension there and how we can breathe to relax here too. Now look at your stomach and your lower part of your chest and body. Are there any tight muscles here? Any tension in the stomach? This is somewhere where we hide a lot of anxiety and concern. But for now, we can let that go. Now, pay attention to your arms. How are your hands? Are they relaxed or are they tense? How are your upper arms? If you need to adjust them, please do. Allow the breath to relax it more. Now pay attention to your legs. Your upper legs and your lower legs. And relax them more. Sometimes the feet and the ankles hold tension, far more than we realize. There's often a lot of tension around the joints. And this is the time to relax them. And now use the breath to brighten the mind, as if the breath can fill the entire body, and as it flows through every limb and every part of your body, it relaxes more, becomes more at ease, more calm, more comfortable. Is your body sending you any messages? How do you want to breathe? Are you still holding on to the breath? Or is it breathing naturally, flowing? Use the time to explore how this feels, and how the breath can relax more. We use the breath to relax the body, and we use the body to relax the breath. And we have that soft smile. Just because this is wonderful. revisit the head and the face by relaxing. More subtle feelings can come out, more subtle tensions we haven't noticed. Use the time to relax these. Now move again to your neck and shoulders and find if there's any subtle tension there. And relax. Now look around the center of your body, including your stomach and your chest and your back. How does it feel? What is it like around your heart and your lungs? Are they soft? Can we make them softer? And let them be. Now revisit your arms. What is it like inside? Allow the breath to flow through them and dissolving any tension. Now revisit your legs and relax those too. See if there's any subtle hidden tension, things that you might never notice. And now, imagine you're in a garden. Imagine a garden filled with thousands of flowers, beautiful flowers. And you're sitting there with a basket filled with flowers. And imagine a person who is very dear to you, someone you love. And give them a flower. And say, thank you for being in my life. And I wish you all happiness in the world. And as you're with that person, send them that kindness, those wishes. May you be happy. May you have good health. And may you have good success in your life. Now imagine someone that you like, but you're not so necessarily close to, and give them a flower and say, thank you for being in my life, and I wish you all the happiness in the world. May you be happy. May you be healthy. And may you have success in your life. And now imagine someone you're not so close to. Someone who causes you trouble. And give them a flower. And you can say, we might not have got along so well, but hopefully we'll have a chance in the future. And I wish you all the happiness in the world. May you be happy. May you be healthy. And may you have success in your life. And now look into the basket and find a flower for yourself and give yourself that flower, a beautiful flower. And you can say to yourself whatever you need to say. Thank you for being in my life. We might not have got along all the time, but I wish you all happiness in the world. And wish yourself happiness. And wish yourself health and every success in your life. And now we can wish the entire world happiness, because it's such a wonderful place, even though it's so troubled. Thank you for being in my life. And I wish you all happiness in the world. May you be happy. May you be healthy. And may you have every success in your life. And allow that kindness, that feeling, to spread as neat, as far as it needs to be. Now use your breath to return to your body. For in a few seconds, I'll ring the gong. And use this last minute just to relax, just to enjoy this feeling, enjoy this moment. Now, you may open your eyes. Welcome back. Are we still online? I turned the microphone off for a little bit, so I'm not sure if it came back on. So we're still here?
Yep. Yes, we're still here, Venerable. And I must say that I think we're feeling very peaceful.
That's wonderful.
Very peaceful. Quite often, we just need a few moments to come back and join with you, especially after such a special time of being with ourselves.
Sometimes coming out of the meditation is just as important as going in. It is true that a lot of the times we sit down perhaps too quickly and we want to come out of it just as fast. But sometimes just that enjoying of it coming out and feeling the room that you're in, feeling the chair, feeling everything else. That is just as important. Meditation doesn't just have to be like a light switch that you turn on and off. A lot of the time it's more this sunrise, sunset effect. It softly goes into darkness and it softly goes into light. So there is a bit of a gradual shift, and that's something to enjoy.
Well, I think that if anybody would like to ask a question, either in the chat or to personally ask a Venerable a question, I'm sure you'd welcome your question.
Yeah.
I have a question. I'm not sure if I'm supposed to raise my hand or...
No, go for it.
Please speak. That would be wonderful. Thank you
so much for the talk and for the guided meditation. And there were several things you said that were really helpful and wonderful. And in the beginning, when you were talking, you mentioned about meditation, of course, it being individual, but that it's also an adventure.
Yes.
And you know, and I wanted to ask about playfulness and almost silliness, mm-hmm. you know, and allowing that into it, because there's always this idea of it needs to be on this sort of track. And maybe it is a track, but can you talk about that, about some, you know, without getting off onto something separate in your meditation, but allowing for your, as an individual venture about playfulness and silliness, and allowing that into it also.
Oh,
is
cool.
There room for it?
Absolutely. You see, the thing is, the only thing that can sit in perfect full lotus for hours and hours and hours is this lump of metal here, because it doesn't feel anything. A Buddha statue can sit perfectly still for hours and days and years on end, but we can't do that. This is the thing for us, it's being more real to who we are and what we're up to. But the playfulness is very important too, because so many times when we have all these troubles and tensions and problems and concerns and anxieties and so on and so on and so on, it's overwhelming. And sometimes we need to just laugh at some of these things. Now, I can remember actually one of the first pieces of advice Ajahn Brahm gave me when I was, before I became a monk, and I was at the monastery, so I was working in the kitchen, and he just looked at me and said, "You have to laugh at all the crazy things that go on here." You know, I'm going, "Oh, okay, righto, fair warning." And bizarrely, like 20 minutes later, after the lunch shift, two other people said exactly the same thing, almost word for word. I'm going, okay, that's a little bit of a message coming in there, kind of thing. Absolutely, the playfulness. The thing is that it is kind of, yes, it is an adventure, but the playfulness can become a little bit too far, because then we can't focus, we can't sit still for a minute, because we want to do things, we want to run and play fun and have energy and everything else. So it's also about balancing that energy and using it in a useful way. And that's where the skill is. That's where the skill is. So the playfulness really helps being able to laugh at our troubles, to be able to smile at all the things that just seem so crazy in this world. Is incredibly useful. And that actually lifts in the meditation as well, because there's plenty of times in our meditation that we aren't necessarily going to have a great time on the chair. We're sometimes going to have times when we kind of would prefer just to sit in front of the TV instead. So there's plenty of times the playfulness comes in. Does that kind of help, or?
Yes, as a matter of fact, when you just said what Ajahn Brahm said to you about you have to laugh at all the crazy things that go on here, that's even something to say to myself during a meditation. You have to laugh at all the crazy things going on here. And to that buoyancy, that inner buoyancy can be also engaged through laughter, and then allow it to open up and aerate what's going on. So
yes.
Thank you for another little nugget there. I appreciate that.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Yeah, that was indeed a great question, Alyssa. Thank you very much. Thank you so much. Does anybody else wish to ask a question? You can put this question in chat if you like, or just ask. Yes, Jim. Jim, could you turn up your volume a bit? Thank you.
Yeah. So that sounds all right now, does it?
Yep, perfect.
Yeah. Thank you, Venerable, for a very interesting and enjoyable talk and a very peaceful meditation. I was just wondering, in the time that you've been as a monk, mm-hmm. have you noticed at all that the focus of Ajahn Brahm's guidance for meditation changes during this, like in the last 8 years or so, or is it relatively constant? If it's not an appropriate question, then feel free not to answer it at all. Thank you.
Well, actually, it has changed. It does change quite a lot. And certainly, It depends on the context, because there's the focus towards the monks as well as when he's on retreat at Jhana Grove and teaching there, or just at the Nolamara Centre or here at Armidale Group. There is always a bit of a reflection of a need. And sometimes as a meditation teacher, it's sometimes important to be able to kind of be sensitive to that need. What does the audience need? The people who are sitting there. Because it doesn't necessarily have to not only be what I need, it's more sort of as in what can I give? What can we use to make a very positive and beneficial meditation for everyone? And because realistically, the world has changed over the last few years. And the shift we've come to is far more this calm, this settling down, not so much sort of this formal traditional style, but more into this kind of this just relax, just calm down. We need to, you know, put the brakes on a little bit and breathe for a little bit. So for Ajahn, on one level, the level of metta practice that he's put in has still continued, but it's become more softer and more real, because we now live in a time which is, you know, with COVID and, you know, political situations and everything else that have been going on around the world, we need it more than ever. So the difficulty is just sticking with one kind of thing and just repeating it over and over and over. Quite honestly, we can just do one guided meditation and then you'd never have to see us again. You can just replay that over and over. Some might think that's a great idea if you're if you want to get away from teaching, but it's a very stale and sterile way of doing it, because it just loses its efficacy and its value. Because what you find is Dharma teachers and meditation teachers are always pointing to what their students need now, what the context and the culture needs, because it's always this pull towards the middle way. I've sort of mentioned this before, but you look at some traditions where there's this very strong interest in the supernatural, in superstitions and things like that. But there's this strong pull in the way they teach Buddhism for debate, rational thought, investigation. Meanwhile, you have other traditions which are very academic, very scholastic, very dry. And they say, put away your books and just sit. And then in our culture, where we have such a need for this calmness, just to be able to find ourselves once again, that's what we go for. Because it's always trying to pull back to this middle way, so we can get to that point that we can then progress in the meditation and it becomes of such greater value. That's essentially why there's so many different traditions, so many different styles. You compare all the different traditions of Buddhism that are out there in the world, and they're all very different. But when you start to see, what is the teacher actually pulling this towards? What is that teacher addressing? What is he or she seeing that their students need? And then all of a sudden, it makes sense. And the problem is, of course, Buddhism can be a bit of a problem, is that we just try and encapsulate it in a bit of a time bubble, and it doesn't become real anymore. So with Ajahn Brahm in particular, he certainly is adapting. And he's adapted a lot more with the COVID situation and everything else. And we'll all continue to adapt. So I don't know if that helps.
Yeah, thank you very much. It was very interesting to hear.
Yeah, you're welcome.
We have a question in the chat, Ajahn. Ajahn, do you have any tips on developing non-self and not being selfish in daily life?
Okay. The thing about non-self is an interesting one, because when we look at it, deep down, we know there's all these problems in the world. We have all these conflicts and challenges we have to face just to survive. So we build up these firewalls. And at the beginning, this is, of course, very, very useful. If we look at, say, evolutionary psychology and things like this, as hunter-gatherers and everything else, human beings were living in small communities, very small communities. And this was a very useful tool to be able to navigate the world. The thing is, as society became more complex and we started living in bigger groups and we had more troubles and more problems and we needed, you know, other people have different agendas, which can be not necessarily so wholesome, the ego started to develop more. those firewalls started to become far more important to us just to survive in the world. The problem is, something happened that we didn't notice. And that is that this ego of ours is a tool. It's a very useful tool. But all of a sudden, the servant became the master. There was a bit of a shift there that we never noticed. And all of a sudden, we're running around looking after this ego. It's become our most precious possession. And we're developing all this time, dedicating our lives to giving it the gratification that it wants, giving it its desires. We're running around basically like the, you know, like slaves, more or less. And the big problem is that sometimes that goes too far. And we don't realize that, you know, we haven't come to ask the question, is that, is it really working? We're giving all this time and effort and energy into this ego. But is it really helping us? And that's a really difficult question that we're not really looking at. We've built up this fortress, this little home of ourselves, and that's very useful for us to navigate the world. But more or less, that's its limits. It's like a tool for a screwdriver. If you want to put a screw in the wall, a screwdriver is a tool par excellence. You can't get better than a screwdriver. But if you want to polish windows or prune roses or, you know, pipe buttercream on a cupcake, a screwdriver is not a particularly good tool for that. So we aren't really aware just where this ego, this tool of ours, which is so useful, has perhaps gone too far. And we're trying to use it in ways which aren't really that useful. So the wisdom element comes in a lot. The moment we can start to see that, we can start to say, okay, it's still useful, it's still important, but I don't need to have it all the time. There's lots of cases where it's not necessary. And we can start to let it go a bit. And we can relax more in our meditation. Part of the reason we have so much selfishness is because there's this inner fear. There's this fortress that we're trying to keep all these things out. We're trying to control everything because we have this concern, these anxieties about the world. And quite honestly, we live in a world where there's a lot to be concerned about. But at the same time, that those problems are just reinforcing the need for this kind of selfishness to protect ourselves and not let anything go. So that's where the meditation and the wisdom come together. The meditation helps us to relax. And for a few minutes, we can put this ego down and we can realize, hang on a minute, I'm not going to die if this ego isn't there for a few minutes. It's not the end of the world. And that's sort of this revolution of thought. This is kind of this big shock. It's like, oh my, I don't need it all the time. There's times it's useful, and there's times where I don't have to worry about it. I don't have to be running around after it. And you can reclaim your life back a bit. So in the Buddhist scheme of things, because to put in a bit of this Buddhist sense, when the Buddha became enlightened under the Bodhi tree, one of the things he said was, house builder, you have been seen. You'll not build this house again. And this house that he was talking about is this ego, this fortress that we have built up. Because he realized that he doesn't need it anymore. And that's what the freedom is. So in Buddhist practice, we have all these different ways of softening. Because we're not trying to destroy the ego. We're not trying to throw it out or disregard it. It's a tool. It's useful for us to navigate our lives. We have it for a reason. But it's not the enemy. It's just a tool that we're misusing. And we haven't noticed that we're using it in the wrong way. We've progressed from self-defense and self-protection in sort of a hunter-gatherer society, then self-gratification, self-desire in normal society, and now we have need for self-help, right? The neuroses and all the problems that are coming out. So the Buddhist practices allow us to calm down, but also to practice generosity, to practice virtue, practice kindness, enjoy ourselves, that little bit of playfulness. Help to soften the ego down, and that can reduce that selfishness. The problem is that selfishness is often a reflection of that inner fear, that fear of missing out, that fear of losing, that fear of what could go wrong. And we don't have to be worried all the time. So does that help? I hope it does. Who knows?
I think what you're saying, Ajahn, is very, very helpful. I was wondering whether you actually had more advice, and I get the feeling, Venerable, that you have tapped into our feelings this evening, and I was wondering, do you have more you would like to say personally, rather than maybe more questions and answers?
Well, personally, I think one of the things...
Just on your topic, okay. Just on your topic.
Well, one of these things which I snuck into the meditation there that you might have noticed was that, Gift, thank you for being in my life. There's a little thing in there. There's a quality in Buddhism which we don't talk about very often, and we don't find it in a text that often, even though the Buddha said it was very important. Because to talk about it can kind of seem a bit tacky. It can kind of seem a bit, you know, we can abuse this situation in a power trip. So it's a quality that's very important. It's that it's called katanyuta in the Pali, this kind of this gratitude for, thank you for being in my life. Thank you to the world for being in my life. I wish you all the happiness in the world. And that particular quality is seldom mentioned in the texts, but the Buddha himself says it's a very rare quality in the world. Because, of course, you can easily imagine that, oh, you guys should be grateful kind of thing. It can easily become exploitative and misused in the wrong way. So this kind of subtle quality comes in is something that we use more in private because it becomes an inner thing. And we can't talk about it so often. But that's the thing with a lot of these qualities, is that they are something far more internal that then can come out. Because once we have it inside, this is this thing that I've mentioned before, that the outside is often a reflection of the inside. One of the things we often find with people who abuse others is that they're often abusing themselves. They attack the innocent because they're attacking themselves. They destroy the beautiful in the world because it's so ugly inside and so painful inside. So inside, that's where we have to start. And then it changes from outside. And that's really, really important. So there's lots of little qualities which help sort of this whole scheme of the Buddhist practice, which are very soft, very gentle, very slow development, because we kind of try to go too fast into Buddhism. We really try and target it and achieve results and feel pressure that we need to achieve results, which is even worse. Where's that going to go to? It's just going to destroy everything, basically, because we're not going to develop any good qualities. We're just going to be trying to force ourselves into a situation where it's not beneficial, and we just create tension and misery, and we just don't want to meditate or practice anything anymore. It's bizarre. But that's what's happened, because firstly, it's an easy way to teach, but also the problem is that we aren't often ready to make that adventure. Sometimes those firewalls are too strong. We don't want to go inside because sometimes it is a bit ugly inside and it hurts sometimes. For some people it's easy, for some people they have difficulties that they have to face, and we have all those firewalls to say, nope, not going there. So we need this practice to soften those. We need to admit that they're there, and that they're there sometimes for very good reasons. For people who have been abused and have been through terrible traumas and all kinds of things, that's what keeps their life together, is by suppressing all this. But that's the problem, is that if you suppress that, at the end, you're just going to be a prisoner to it. So it's an adventure, for sure. But it's basically that giving that gift to yourself, that inner strength, that you can do this, and that it is worth doing. It is the greatest gift. So I don't know if that helps. That might be interesting. I'm not sure.
No, think that's a very beautiful thought that you've offered us, and your kindness and gentleness tonight is, I think, very special, very, very special and venerable. Is there anybody else who would like to offer something or ask a question? Or venerable, would you like to continue speaking to us?
Well, if there are any questions, they're welcome to take precedent.
There's no questions in the chat at the moment, venerable. I think everybody is really, really taken with your words this evening. So if you have something else to say, venerable, we'd be very, very happy to hear.
Okay. With these qualities, in a sense, part of the thing that we have to go through is to find out what we really want. What do we really want out of our meditation, out of Buddhism, out of life? What is it that we really want? Because for a lot of Buddhism, it's about developing these good things. Because why not? Think about it. These wonderful qualities are there. Sure, a lot of the time we can't use them. There's a lot of context that we have to focus on other things. We have to work. We have to do all these things. We can't always use them as we would like. But why not? They're such rare things, such wonderful things. So in a sense, these qualities are worth exploring, just slowly, just to see what comes out. Because all the different meditation approaches, all the ways that Buddhism has been taught throughout the centuries, has been moving in this direction, in the same direction, even though it doesn't look like it from the outside. But by developing these wonderful things, what we find inside is that it's beautiful inside. And all of a sudden, you're happy to be with yourself. You don't have to be afraid of looking inside yourself anymore. Or you don't have to be concerned of what you're going to find, what's going to come out of the woodwork, which often happens, because that is what happens when you do sitting meditation where you do absolutely nothing. If you just close your eyes and do absolutely nothing, after a few minutes, stuff is going to come out of your mind. It can be things that you've been exposed to a lot. So some people might be having a jingle of some advert that's stuck in their head, or that some song they've been listening to on the radio or something else. All of a sudden, the mind is trying to fill that emptiness, because there's this inner fear of emptiness. Whereas, ironically, that's part of the problem. That inner fear controls us so much. And those firewalls control us so much. And we put them up for good reasons. But, as I said before, something happened that we didn't notice. That those tools, the servant, so to speak, that's there to protect us, became the master. And it's now running our life. And it doesn't need to. But, to be able to do that, we need to start building that good relationship with ourselves. Because you're never going to be able to face these things and grow all these wonderful qualities if it's not going to be a benefit to you. And that's the thing. That's when we look at, what are we doing this for? What is it that I really want? And all of a sudden we can kind of see, oh, okay, now I have a direction, or the direction I was taking was probably a bit self-centered, a bit unrealistic. We can adjust that. We can work with that. So the possibilities are immense. And it's about enjoying it. Because this is the thing. Where else in the world would people even think of doing this? Most of the time, most people have no idea what goes on inside. And yet, that's what's driving them, how they act in the world, how they act in their families, how they act in all their relationships, their workplace and everything else. They're being driven from these forces inside that they're not aware of. But the moment that you start being aware of them and having that good relationship with yourself is what allows you to see that, because there's that firewall inside that says that you might not be ready for this, so we're not going there. I don't think you can deal with this, we're not going there. You're not strong enough to deal with this, forget it. There are these firewalls that we have put up against ourselves. And that's a big one. And meditation helps soften that. The kindness helps soften that. The compassion, the joy, and the playfulness and the adventure, and all these other good qualities soften that. And living a good quality of life inside ourselves, we can trust ourselves now. That we can see things deeper. And that's what the whole process is about. How about that? Does that spike an interest?
I think it might have sparked an interest in Rachel, actually, to be honest with you. She said a very interesting comment. It's very much along the theme of what you've just been speaking about in the chat, Rajan. Mm-hmm. If you don't mind, I'd like to read it to you.
No, please.
Thank you. How do we let the firewalls come down without being too frightened of the emotions and thoughts and experiences which arise, especially if people's firewalls are there because of abuse or trauma?
Yeah. See, this is the thing. Sometimes we don't. Sometimes we spend our time building up that relationship, that trust with ourselves first. Some traumas are terrible. Some people have been through really frightening, horrible things. Some people, you know, have been abused. It's, you know, there's lots of different problems. And if the person does not have the skills to be able to face that, it can cause far more damage. The reason that we built up those firewalls is a self-protection mechanism. So it's all about realizing that we can do this. We build up confidence with ourselves. We develop these good skills. We develop good friendships, good relationships, so we can feel safer and more confident that we can do this. Because this is the thing, if we go too fast, you're going to get pushback. Because the mind's going to say, no, you're not ready for this. I'm going to scare you out because this is what, you know, I'm going to kick you out of your meditation, I'm going to kick you out of this because you're not going there. It's a slow process. So for deep trauma, it is slow. But the benefits are greater because the freedom is greater. Because those traumas have created such a small, tight little fortress, a firewall that's so cast iron. It's a real prison. And it's horrible to be inside those. But for those persons, it's the only way they feel they can survive, that they can keep things together, even though it can seem so dysfunctional and so unbeneficial. But they don't know any better. That's the difficulty. They're not aware of any tools or any skills or ways of being able to deal with that. So at the beginning, always about developing that good relationship with yourself. So critical. Because then slowly, 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 we can trust ourselves. We know we have these skills that we can manage this. We have sort of the patience, the acceptance, the kindness, the compassion, all these good things we've done that we can look back on, all this past generosity, all these wonderful things we've done. We can look back on that and give ourselves a bit more of a boost, a bit more of a support, that we are good people. We have lived good lives. Yes, there's this trauma, there's this problem deep inside we have to deal with. And that can come. We now give ourselves the freedom to tackle the elephant in the room. Because the elephant in the room's not really going to go away. And that's the thing. It's admitting that. So it's very, very challenging for them. But building that inner strength is critical. So I don't know if that helps. The kindness is... Metta is very important.
I think, Ajahn, yes, you have touched the heart. Yeah, you really well and truly have touched the point. And yes, kindness. Kindness is I feel it in my teaching, in my work teaching, that my students change. The kinder I am to myself, the kinder I am with them, no matter what the interaction that I have with them, if I treat it with kindness, we can create something of beauty in our relationships together. Now, Mei Mei has a question for you, Venerable. I'd like to read it to you.
No, please.
Thank you, Venerable, for the teaching. I have been feeling that there is the conceptual reality, which is in our minds and perceptions, and experiential reality, which is what we experience. Do you have any advice on how to lean into the experiential reality and trust in our ability to handle it, such as the conceptual idea of illness, which actually frightens us more than the experiential reality of being ill?
It's one of the tragedies of the world, is that's really how it is. We have this conceptual framework, these ideas of what might happen, and they terrify us so much that we won't even go there. Because it's a bit like what we were talking about before with the traumas. Sometimes it's not necessarily that we hate the person outside that have done this to us. Sometimes we hate ourselves that we got caught in that trap, that we were in that situation, that we lost our happiness. Where there's this anger there sometimes, or this fear, this loss, this regret, this remorse. So those feelings create the conventional reality, the thought world. And that's what drives it. The experience, though, is coming back to it. And of course, the meditation is very, very useful for that, because it's a skill to relax. You feel the breath, you feel the body. The mind is a bit slippery at the moment. You know, don't worry too much about the mind. The experiential side, coming back to the body, is far more real and it's far more accessible. Just the problem is, sometimes there's a lot of tension there. And particularly for people who have a lot of illness or chronic pain, we just don't want to go near the body because it's just more of these problems that we've had before. So we're running away, trying to get it wherever we can, away from here. And that's where it starts to become that practice. That's where it starts to slowly, slowly, slowly start to relax. And quite often, it might not be in a meditation context. It might be just going to run around the block or something and get all that tension out, or to sit in a spa or something or a massage chair. That might be far more productive at the beginning to calm us down and to bring us more into a state of mind. Or having a nice cup of tea, or just to read a good book or something. It doesn't necessarily have to be meditation at the beginning. It's just something to calm us down, and then we can move into it. So the thing about the conventional is that we've built it up for a very, very long time, and we've been building it up in each other. We teach our children how to think how we think. We indoctrinate, condition each other. We're getting it all the time from advertising. You know, that's the dark arts of conventional reality. That's their profession. And then we have the media, we have everything else. Every source of information we have is there to reinforce a conventional reality. And all of it is getting away from the experiential, because sometimes the experiential is just, we don't know what this is. We don't know how to deal with it. That's where the adventure comes in, because we don't know. Our own minds and our own bodies is like new frontier. We don't know it. We spent our whole lives looking outside, and we've never looked inside. So managing that can be tricky at the beginning, because we're so not only used to the conventional, there's a little part of us that depends on it, that kind of feels that we can't really manage and navigate our lives without it. You know, these are all these things that we have to look at, is that these things sort of, these are always the questions that people ask. If we sort of say, if we let go of our ego, how are we going to function in the world? And it kind of shows deep down that we know how important this tool is to us. And the social conventions, social convention reality is a tool. But it's become the master. It's taken over. And we bring that down through the samatha upasana, we calm things down, we can see things more clearly. And it's that interest to investigate. What is this? What is this amazing world that's sometimes so terrible? What is this? You know, that's often the beginning for students. To be a real student is to know that we don't know. And that can be, you know, quite deflating for our egos, but it's kind of, at the same time, it opens vast new horizons. Where can we take this to? Where can this go? And that's the adventure.